This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Up close and personal with the Health Minister, Mike Nesbitt. He was sitting in that very chair for half an hour. It was personal, it was political, we talked about policy, we talked about the practicalities of running the health service. And is he going to create some sort of a new job, a chief executive, some sort of health czar to help him, Mike Nesbitt, run the health service? He hinted at that. We don't know the exact detail. Have a listen. There's a lot in it. We also talk about the latest twist in the battle over the Boyne Bridge, and we talk about work-life balance. I'm a bit of a hypocrite here. Mine has been suffering recently, but it's been good fun. This is The Nolan Show. Have a listen.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning. The Health Minister, Mike Nesbitt, is right beside me in the studio. We do know the issues. We don't need to waste time setting them out. So let's get stuck in. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Mark.
I want to deal with the personal, the politics, and then some policy questions. Starting with the personal. There's a crisis. Have you made mistakes?
Not that I'm aware of. But I do ask myself, could I have done better? And I don't know the answer to that in a specific sense. But I imagine the answer is yes, I could have done better, because you can always do better. And I anticipate I will find out in the coming weeks and months when I deliver my promise to get all the stakeholders around the table with a blank page and say, how do we fix it or do better next winter?
20 years ago, you were the person asking the questions. There must still be a bit of a journalist in there. Something says to me, looking across the table at you, that you know a lot more than you can say. If you were me, what would you ask the health minister?
I haven't actually addressed it in those terms, Mark, so it's an interesting question.
Okay.
What would I ask the health minister?
What is the story? I mean, there must be things. We've got a bit of space and a bit of time.
Yeah, okay.
Well, what is going on that maybe you haven't said before and you can now tell our listeners? You know, there's a huge listenership here.
Right. There's no secret. There's no hidden secret.
Okay.
It is about the flow. And you're right to say we know what the problem is. And the problem in terms of EDs is the flow. The problem isn't the ED. That's where the problem manifests itself. That's where we see it. But it's the flow, and the big problem is what we're calling the back door. In other words, patients who are ready to leave hospital, but they can't because they don't have a care home bed or they don't have a domiciliary or home care package.
We'll come back to that.
Okay.
One last personal question. Just after you'd been appointed, I was on a beach, surprise, surprise, and someone who's quite high up in medical circles overheard you in a hospital. I don't like doing this because they may have been eavesdropping. And they heard you say to somebody in a hospital, this is June last year, listen, I'm not running in the next election. I don't need to be looking over my shoulder. I can do what needs to be done.
Yeah, I would have said that. And you know, the last February when Stormont came back, I was very happy on the back benches and I was, in my terms, cruising towards retirement. I was the economy spokesman and I was representing my party on the policing board. So events, dear boy, events came along. Robin moved on and I couldn't resist the challenge. And it's a very privileged challenge of going into health. And then the other job came along. So the position I'm in today is that I'm going to have to make a decision around about May of 2026 about whether I stick with I'm going to retire or whether I'm going to go again. Because events have changed. The circumstances are different.
The person that said this to me may be disappointed because they were delighted with that. They thought, this is a politician who's not thinking about the next election. And if he or she sees things that needs to be done, they're going to do them.
That has not changed. I will still have that attitude even come May 26 if I should decide, actually, I've got one more go in me.
Okay. Let's take a couple of quick fire things that you could do. reduce the number of trusts?
I've thought about that. Northern Ireland is small enough and the population is of a sufficient number that you could say, why do you have five geographic trusts? Why not have one? But if I did that, I am convinced it would become a distraction. So much energy and resource would be put into that transformation of the structures that actually delivery would lose a bit of focus. And if you think about some of the major reconstructions we have done, reorganisations in politics, 26 councils into 11, has that delivered the savings that we said it would? No, it hasn't. The Education Authority came along to replace Educational Library Boards. Has that made the difference that we were told it would? No, it hasn't. So what I'm doing, and I've said this to the chief execs and to the trusts, and they know my position, in my head, those five trusts are one. And what I want them to do, and they are starting to collaborate and cooperate on this, find best practice wherever it is and roll it out so that it's common practice so that we have regional services that are consistent.
What about this idea of bringing in sort of a czar, a chief executive, somebody to bang those heads together on the trusts? Okay, it's another big salary. What about that idea?
You're not far off the money.
Tell us more.
I can't tell you a lot more at this stage, but there are changes in terms of senior officials coming this year.
So there is a story that Mike Nesbitt, the old journalist, wasn't willing to admit initially. But tell us a bit more, Mike. Come on. Even if it doesn't happen, people aren't going to be hanging you out to dry. What's your thinking here?
Well, it's not my thinking. It is the fact that some people have decided to move on. Some people are at an age where perhaps they're thinking about retirement. So there will be some changes, and that gives an opportunity to look not only at replacements, who's going to be the next this and that, but also in terms of how we structure things so we can do it a bit more, potentially a bit more efficiently.
Could this be one supremo, kind of somebody just below you that is in charge of all the trusts?
You're not far off the money.
Can you tell us any more?
No.
Okay. I may return to that. The politics. We're going to have a quick listen to Michelle O'Neill. She seems to be saying two things here. We'll hear what she has to say in a moment. On the one hand, she's saying, we've got your back. On the other hand, she's saying, let's not tear strips off each other. And you have been tearing off some strips. Have a listen.
One minister will not solve that. There needs to be a collective effort. I've made that case very clearly to the Health Minister. I made it at the executive meeting last week. We need to work in tandem. The public want to hear about what we're going to do about it. We know what the challenges are. We know that the issue of discharges into social care are not there. The places, the beds aren't there. So what are we going to do about it? That's what I want us as an executive to talk about. Not turn strips off each other as ministers.
What do you make of that?
Well, I think Michelle O'Neill is genuine in terms of saying it's a collective effort and that she wants to help. I have got no difficulty at all with the First Minister in that regard. I don't feel I am tearing strips off people. I think I'm trying to be realistic. So in the statement we put out yesterday,
which was tearing strips off other ministers?
No, it wasn't tearing strips off other ministers. What happened was the draft budget was published. It's out to consultation. Part of our response has to be we've got an obligation to do an equality impact assessment, and the result of that is we think we're in for more of the same rather than the ability to do the big reform piece that I would like to do.
Mike, I have to quote you your last line from that statement yesterday. You're saying to your fellow ministers, are you comfortable taking your position?
Nope.
When I say comfortable, I do not mean politically, I mean morally.
That was directed at members of the Legislative Assembly, not at the ministers of the Executive, Mark. And let me make this point, if I may. Every day, every single day, MLAs are among those who are coming to me and they're saying, for example, more needs to be done about dementia patients. More needs to be done about adult ADHD. Yesterday, it was more needs to be done about bowel cancer screening because we're now out of step with England, Scotland and Wales who offer it from 50. We don't offer it until you're 60. And they're right. But what they aren't acknowledging is to do all those things, you need resource. And resource means you need money. And in the same breath, they're saying you've got over 50% of the budget, get on with it. And the percentage is a red herring. Because what we should be doing is assessing the budget that health needs based on need, on assessed need. And remember, to get the Assembly back in February, we had to go and argue with Treasury and with London that the block grant should not be based on accrued headcount, as it was, but it should be based on assessed need. And on that basis, we went from getting 100 pence for every pound spent in England to 124. Yet when it comes to the health budget, assessed need is out the window and everybody says, oh, get on with it, you've got over half the budget.
The one key question that a lot of people want me to ask you, who aren't members of the DUP or Sinn Féin, is do you believe if they had one of their own in the executive as health minister, if it was, say, Edwin Puts or Liz Kimmins as health minister, they would get more money?
I don't know the answer to that, and I would like to think that the answer to that is no, that because that really would be playing party politics with people's health.
You don't know?
Well, you would have to. I would have to stand down to test it. But I would go back to the fact that you've just played that clip of the First Minister. I believe Michelle O'Neill is genuine in saying we need to work together on this.
Have you ever had a moment, you've only been in there, what, 7 or 8 months, where you have thought about standing down?
No. Oh, absolutely not. No, I'm not going to walk away from this challenge.
Could you walk away from the next budget?
I don't. Personally, no, I don't see the point of that. I think it's better to stay in and argue. And that's why I put that statement out yesterday, because remember, this is still a draft budget. It's out for public consultation. Yes. That consultation's open to the 13th of March.
Yep.
So I want to alert the public, if they care about the health service, please respond to the draft budget.
Speaking of the budget, as you say, you know, we can all have our say up until just before St. Patrick's Day. Joanne McBurney was at the Department of Finance Committee yesterday, and she was asked about the health budget. She's a senior official in the Department of Finance. This is what she had to say.
I don't want to get into an argument around health. I would say all departments are facing challenges in that, but the question is quite simply, if the money goes to health, then it doesn't go somewhere else. Mm. And I think as we see all departments launch their own equality impact assessments, I think the vast majority of departments will be saying, we have issues, we have pressures, which begs the question, if we give more to health, where do we take it from?
Mm-hmm. Joanne McBurney is a very senior and a very good official, in my experience, and I don't disagree with what she's saying, and that's why I think collectively the executive needs to sit down and perhaps in greater detail discuss each other's pressures and then prioritise them.
You've been round probably school governor meetings as well. Everybody knows what the problem is in any situation, but are you going to be the person that bangs the table and says, do you know what, Gordon Lyons? You don't need money for this. And you know what, Keith Archibald, you could take money from his or her budget. Have you come up with that radical plan? Because that's maybe what it's going to need.
Well, it's also, to my mind, part of the role of the Department of Finance to assess the needs and the risks in terms of the tight budgets. And I accept every minister is working with a budget that doesn't suit their purposes and their needs in full. So what I'm saying is, if you cut my budget too tightly, you're putting lives at risk. This is about people's health. Now, I understand that we have to do better in terms of tackling, for example, educational underachievement. So I've got sympathy there. We need to build a new A5 because people are losing their lives on that road. I understand there are competing pressures and there's insufficient money for everybody. But have we really sat down and prioritised and understood the kind of league table of needs and the implications when services are cut?
Would it not help your argument to say, I've done a bit of research, or my researchers or my department has done a bit of research, or my political party has done a bit of research. Kiva, here you are. This is where I think you could save money and give it to me.
I don't see that as my role. I think that is perhaps the role of the executive and particularly the role of the Department
happen,
of Finance.
Though, Mike. I mean, you know better than me. You've been around politics longer than me.
Yeah. Well, all I can do is argue my corner.
Okay. It brings me to another point. And, you know, thank you. You give me 24 hours notice for this interview. And I talked to a few people around Stormont and, you know, you're well got, Mike. People remember you from, you know, your victims commissioner's days, whether or your time at UTV, your time at the BBC. And people talk about your personal skills, your communication skills. If I'm hearing one criticism, if you don't mind me saying...
Oh, please do.
...is that you're maybe not bold enough. You're maybe not radical enough. You maybe don't have the vision or maybe the courage to make a really radical suggestion. What do you say to that? I'll give you a bit of time.
I'm surprised that people are saying I don't have the vision, because I believe I've articulated the vision pretty consistently since...
Sorry, vision for the radical. To think the unthinkable. To shake people up.
Well, I think I have, and I may be going into an area where
oh, please do.
I shouldn't...
Oh, please do.
Well, it's important to me that when I'm having quiet conversations with people, tough conversations, that they understand that they're in a safe place and that I'm not going to come onto the Nolan Show and blab about it. But I'll make an exception on this, because I think it's important within the context of your question. Do I have what it takes to sit down and have those hard conversations with people? So I have sat with very senior figures in the five geographic trusts about productivity and efficiency. And I put it like this. If you order 10 items off Amazon and 7 are delivered, how many are you going to pay for? Because I'm paying for 10 in terms of, say, elective surgery, but you're only delivering 7. So what we're now doing is we're saying, those 3 that you didn't deliver, what were the reasons for that? And sometimes there's a reasonable explanation. So, for example, a surgeon is involved in a road traffic collision en route to the hospital. So it's a last minute thing. I can accept that. But if the anaesthetist has said 7 or 10 days out, I can't do that list on Wednesday week, and you didn't make the effort to replace them, then that's not okay. And we've actually taken £2.3 million back off a trust for non-delivery. So I think I am bold enough to make those decisions. And the vision is that famous shift left. The whole emphasis at the moment is curing the sick in acute hospitals. I want the emphasis on community and primary care, GP surgeries. I want to put the emphasis on keeping the healthy healthy, because that will take all the pressure off, well, not all the pressure, but that will take an awful lot of the pressure off the acute hospitals. Let's think about shifting left, so we've got care in the community, and that's my Live Better initiative, by the way, which is about to start in 2 demonstration areas. It's going to look at health inequalities. Mm. It's going to look at the fact that people's healthy lifetime expectancy can vary by as much as 14.2 years. Now, in 2025, exactly a quarter of the way into the 21st century, here in a first world country, is it acceptable that 2 women born the same day in the same maternity unit in this city can have life expectancy, or healthy life expectancies, that vary by over 14 years? No, it's not even conscionable.
In fairness, the people that offered that criticism of you, by and large, also made the point that it was a compliment. They believe you've got too much of a heart for this. We've seen you get emotional in interviews. We've seen you get emotional at the assembly. I mean, you care passionately about this place. We see it. And you're maybe not ruthless enough, which brings us back to the potential story you've given us of bringing in somebody underneath you that may be more prepared to take those more business-like decisions, if you don't mind me saying.
Well, I'll take that on board. That's the first time I've heard that. I'll not even call it a criticism, a critique.
Critique.
Okay, I certainly take that on board. But I do believe I'm surprised at it, because I think people do recognise that I can take big and difficult decisions.
Speaking of Andrea, and I think in fairness, the team told you about this beforehand, you can't talk about individual cases, but as you know, there are dozens, hundreds, thousands of them out there.
All health is personal.
Sure.
So.
Sure. Good point. Andrea got in touch with the Nolan Show. She's been told her weight on a waiting list for an operation is 300 weeks. What do you say to Andrea and everybody else?
I can only apologise to her. And I have seen tables of waiting lists, Mark, and some people have been waiting over 500 weeks. That's 10 years. That's a decade. Of course it's not acceptable. And part of it, I absolutely accept, is about productivity and it's about efficiency. But I swear to you, no amount of efficiency and productivity will on its own close the gap between demand and health and social care's ability to meet that demand because of the capacity that we have. So it does need more investment. And I'm not talking about huge sums of money, because I believe once you start that shift left, once you start investing in more community and primary care, that, particularly over the long term, will take a lot of the pressure off the acute hospitals who are out to the right. But that's where all the really expensive stuff happens. But that's expensive stuff curing the sick. So if we can keep the healthy healthy for longer, we will change that dynamic and the finances will flow with it.
Primary care. I texted a GP that I know last night and they had two questions for you. One you've answered. One was about consolidating the trusts. The other one, surprise, surprise, was more cash for primary care. Are they going to get it?
They're going to get a bit more cash. The big issue, the one that is almost toxic to my mind at the moment, is about indemnity. And we put something in for this financial year, but this financial year only. I'm going to frustrate you by saying we're right on the cusp of finding out whether GPs are going to accept our longer-term solution. Those negotiations or those discussions, I believe, maybe at the end point, and I don't know what the result is, but I am optimistic that it will be a positive result. And I think that that will be transformational in terms of the relationships, and that will make it easier to build on those relationships going forward. Because I need GPs, and I know when I say I want to shift left, to begin with, at least they were thinking, my goodness, the guy's going to ask us to do more for the same. And I realised you can't do that. I was with a couple of GPs yesterday, Mark, and I came to the conclusion very early in this job that we have, for whatever reason, over a long period of time, overcomplicated healthcare delivery. And I started saying this, and I thought, I'm probably going to get some blowback from people who've been delivering healthcare for a long time, and they're going to deconstruct that or tell me I'm wrong. But even the guy yesterday, he said, I'm 35 or 36 years in this business as a GP. And when I started articulating that to him, he just started smiling and nodding. And I think he was smiling because he was relieved that he said, you know, here's a minister who understands. We have overcomplicated it, and I want to simplify it. And we are doing that in some ways. So you think about, for example, the introduction over the last number of years of advanced nurse practitioners, and they can do a lot of stuff that GPs do. So it's a relief, I think, to a patient to be told you don't have to wait a week to see your GP. You can see the advanced nurse practitioner in 5 minutes.
And sadly, the next step, EDs, corridor care, you may have heard our health correspondent Marie-Louise Connolly's report this morning. The bottom line, Mike, I'm sorry to do this again and get personal, but you're the person in charge and corridor care is happening on your watch.
Corridor care is a thing. It didn't start on my watch. Will it end on my watch? That would be an ambition. I'm not sure it can be... Can it be fixed in its entirety by next winter? That is a bold ambition. But as I said, I am going to get all the stakeholders around the table. We are going to start with a blank sheet and we are going to do a real co-design to make sure that we are doing our absolute best. I've been in 6 EDs since Christmas Day, Mark.
Including Christmas Day?
I wasn't in an ED on Christmas Day. I was in a hospital on Christmas Day.
Oh, fair enough.
And a couple other places. So they're very different. You know, if you go up to Elton & Gelvin, it's the oldest one. My goodness, there's only 2 WCs. There's no area to wash.
Oh.
I mean, and I met somebody who'd been in the same chair for 4 days.
Yeah.
And, you know, you should not, as a patient, have to surrender your dignity and your privacy when you arrive in a hospital. And the nurses and the doctors and the allied health professionals and the staff who are working should not have to feel that kind of moral indignity and moral damage, because they know what they can do for patients, but they also know what they're being restricted from doing for patients because of the environment in which they're working. Take, for example, every ED has resus bays for resuscitation. And those patients who go in there, I mean, they're in a bad way. They need resuscitated.
Oh.
you maybe have two bays but three patients, or you have five bays and seven patients who need in. You're having to make a decision about the least worst option. You're taking somebody out of that resuscitation bay who really should still be staying, but you're doing it because there's somebody even worse who needs in.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
That shouldn't be the way of it.
Two last quickies. We've missed our deadline.
That's okay.
That's okay. Two last things. Vaccines. You increased the threshold for those who were able to get vaccines. Anything else you can do this winter? Because there are people probably listening in hospital at the moment, or doctors or nurses coming off shifts wondering, is there anything you can do now?
Believe me, we have been round the houses asking for levers to pull between now and the end of the winter pressures. And by the way, I think we have to stop talking about winter pressures. We should talk about the additional winter pressures, because the pressures are 365.
Final question. I really want you to tell me more about this other person you made appointing. Come on.
No, I think with just the way things are falling, with people kind of moving on, I think there is an opportunity for a restructuring, but it's not a major restructuring. But yeah, it is looking about perhaps having somebody who is more across the day-to-day operations of the Geographic Trust particularly.
Ooh. Would they be called a czar or a chief executive?
Well, you in the media might so do, but there might be a different title.
Mike Nesbitt, thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome.
Mike Nesbitt, the Health Minister, will get some reaction to that after the news. We've just been speaking to the Health Minister, Mike Nesbitt, for 30 minutes. Very personal remarks from him about what it's like behind the scenes, what his priorities are, deflecting some of the criticism that is being made behind the scenes as well. But if you missed it, I would ask you to rewind on BBC Sounds and you can hear some intriguing answers, including it looks like, he wouldn't give us full detail, he may be having a mini restructuring within the Department of Health, and he may be creating some sort of an overseer. He was a bit vague on the details, but it's interesting. So we talked about the big picture. We also talked about one patient in particular. Her name is Andrea. She's on a waiting list. Andrea, good morning to you. Were you listening to Mike Nesbitt?
I was indeed, Mark.
He has sympathy for you. Does that help?
No.
Tell us your situation, Andrea.
I first had to attend NE in 2023. Firstly, I live with Parkinson's, early onset Parkinson's disease, but I had become unwell, and ever since then, for 20 months now, I've been in and out of NE 23 times. I've had 15 CT scans and other tests and things. And I believe if, you know, all that, I could have had my surgery done. I'm waiting the surgery I have, 300 weeks, that's just under 6 years. I don't think I'd be well or fit enough by then, because of the Parkinson's as well, because it's took a big impact on my everyday life.
I take it you're in a lot of discomfort.
I'm in, as it's classed in the paperwork as well, I'm chronic pain and multifactorial pain because of a lot of other things as well as Parkinson's and the waiting on the surgery. So yes, I only leave the house basically to go to the hospital or GP appointments, which I'm for the matter this afternoon.
And when you were told, Andrea, 300 weeks, what did you say?
I cried all day because I said I wouldn't get emotional. I'm 57, Mark. You know, Parkinson's hasn't stopped me living, but the past 20 months has. And I was told yesterday, 300 weeks. I actually pity the people, that the elderly, especially the vulnerable, who are going to suffer in silence because of nobody to speak up for them. You know, I can speak for myself, as you well know. But it's just, it's disgraceful. As somebody said to me, Mark, you'd get treated better in a veterinary clinic if you were an animal. And that's the truth, you know. I just don't know what else to say. You know, I've tried, I've rang places. I've done work of people, you know, to try and get the help there for myself. I paid for private care, and let me tell you, I don't have a lot of money. But rather than wait and wait, but I've been asked recently by two doctors if I could pay for the surgery, the two operations in one. I would never have that amount of money ever to do that, unfortunately.
Did they tell you roughly how much it might cost?
Well, I kind of researched it myself, but then you have to remember, Mark, there's the follow-up care. The operation that I'm waiting on, it's two operations actually in one. And then, you're talking anywhere up to, I would say, £10,000 to £15,000.
Oh, my goodness.
You know? And to be asked that by a doctor, you know, it's shocking. It's really scary, to be honest, to think that another 6 years of this, you know.
Oh, so Andrea.
Mark, I'm back on. I had to accept help in the line of antidepressants because I'm usually very positive and very, nothing will beat me like I have with the Parkinson's, but this year's just took the wind beneath me. So I'm trying my best to keep going, you know, and everything. But
well, Andrea, I want to encourage you. I mean, you've shown great, great courage this morning. It's not easy. You're telling your story on the radio. Mm-hmm. We've put it to the Health Minister. You know, you're doing everything you can. You don't have 15 grand.
No,
but you're doing everything that you can. There's that old expression, you know, start where you are, use what you've got and do what you can. And Andrea, you're doing that. And we're proud of you. We're proud of you.
Mark, can I add, you see the staff in the hospitals, especially down in Belfast, they're working under immense. I was in there for 18 days in August in the Royal. And honestly, the need, double the pay they're getting. It's, you know, for what they're doing under immense pressure.
Andrea, who knows? We're not asking for special treatment for you
not.
Because there are thousands of others in a similar situation. Maybe not all 300 weeks, in fairness, but we've put it to the Health Minister directly.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, take some encouragement from that. The guy at the top knows about your case. We've also put this to the Southern Trust. Bear with me, I don't know if you've heard this, but this is what a spokesperson says. There may not be much comfort in this, but again, we've highlighted your case. They say, we very much regret the excessive waiting times for surgery. We absolutely acknowledge the impact that unacceptably long waiting times have on the lives of our patients and their families. Mm-hmm. We continue to prioritise and treat patients by the urgency and severity of their illness in line with guidance. I suppose the one crumb of comfort there for you, Andrea, if sadly your symptoms are so bad, it might be a lot earlier than 300 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Mark, can I add, I'm actually on an urgent list, so what would it be like for people on a routine list?
Well, that's a good point.
You know, it's...
That is a good point.
Yeah.
What about your GP? Is your GP a good help?
There's only so much they can take because I've been told numerous times because of the Parkinson's, they're limited to what they can give me as a GP, etc. And because of their referrals are already away for everything, you know, it's really out of their hands and they can only give me the minimum pain relief, you know, that which it's difficult, you know.
You were listening to Mike Nesbitt. Did you hear the other stuff apart from the bit when I asked him about you?
Yes.
What did you make of him?
I think he would be true to his word. And I think he will try his best.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's hope he tries his best, you know, that he can. And that's all really. There's not much, unfortunately, we can do, you know, other than hope and pray, you know.
Are you into the politics of it all in terms of whether you think he should get more money from the other ministers?
To be honest, it's a bit. I think Stormont could do more. The time they have had off and everything, that could have been put to good use.
Yeah.
Maybe things wouldn't have got as bad as they have. Because this talk about the NHS broken.
Mm-hmm.
How about some of the patients, Mark? If I want to be extreme, I'm broken.
Mm-hmm. Andrea, I'm going to let you go.
Okay,
but before you go, I want to thank you. I want to encourage you. I want to give you a radio hug and tell you that I'm going to be thinking of you.
Okay, thank you.
I just want you just to say one more time that if Mike Nesbitt is listening in the car on his way up to Stormont, I think there's another executive meeting today. What are you saying to all of those ministers?
Mark, it's hard to say to get it across, but just try your best, Mr. Nesbitt. You know, there's so many people, lives are going to be lost. That's basically it.
Andrea, will you keep in touch with us?
I will, surely, Mark. Thank you.
Good on you.
And thank you for giving me this opportunity.
It's been our pleasure. Thanks for
phoning
in.
Okay.
Do you know what? It's not easy. No matter how old I get, the more I realise it's not easy to phone into a radio programme. I take my hat off to you if I was wearing a hat, Andrea. Thank you. The time is coming up to 9:45. Let's get some political reaction to what we've heard this morning. First of all, Nuala McAllister from the Alliance Party. Can you give any encouragement there to Andrea? God love her.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, Mark, and good morning, Andrea. I know that she's away, but I was listening to it and she seems absolutely broken, and it's just heartbreaking to hear. And Andrea's not the only person that we speak to every day. I do believe that it will get better if we actually make the effort in order to do that. You know, there are actions that can be taken, so hopefully let's knuckle down and actually take those actions and see people like Andrea get the surgeries that they actually need to improve their lives. I think that there's a possibility, and we just need to be brave enough to actually do it.
Colin McGrath from the SDLP is on the line as well. Good morning, Colin. What would you say to Andrea and everybody else?
Well, I mean, what we hear from Andrea is the real face of what our health service is like, the state of it. We know the difficult situations that people are facing, and we hear those every day. And we also know that the health service is in bad shape, and we know that the staff are worked to the bone, and we know that our GP practices are under budgetary constraints and problems. But we also know that executive by media is failing people, and a minister coming on to tell people how bad his department is and how difficult it is for him to run it, and that other executive parties won't give him enough money, isn't really the best way to do government. They should be sitting around a table having the conversation. They should be strategizing together, and they should be delivering for Andrea and others that are having to wait for 300 weeks to get treatment. But we know that coming on and giving a very fine presentation for half an hour that tells us exactly what we know is not what's going to be a solution. And if there are hints towards significant restructuring in terms of the Department of Health, I'd like to think that the Assembly Health Committee will hear that, because we also know from experience over the years that solo runs don't sort out situations in our government either. So I would like to think that there could be an executive and Assembly involvement and response to that.
What do you think he was hinting at there, Colin McGrath, in terms of this new position?
I don't know, other than what he said, you know, but I hope that we can get to a situation where elected representatives don't have to hear about major initiatives on the radio, because we as elected representatives can bring the real problems. We listen to the sector. We know what the issues and problems are. So I hope we'll get that opportunity.
Well, in fairness to him, Colin, and I know my mum says self-praise is no praise, I think I got that out of him. He didn't come onto the radio wanting to say that this morning. I think it slipped out.
Things don't slip out from ministers' mouths. Okay. Let's be very clear about that. You're long enough involved in politics and journalism to know that. But we will see where that goes. But look, it doesn't detract from the problems that people are facing every day. And they heard the minister there for nearly half an hour and they didn't hear a solution. So that's where we need to start moving towards.
Oh, he did have ideas. He did have ideas.
He didn't give us any ideas. I mean, we have to be perfectly honest here. And I think Colin would probably share, as do other members of the Health Committee, and I'm getting utterly fed up, is that we don't hear detail from this minister. We don't hear detail from the department as to what action can be taken. We know that the winter pressures of this year were in action and plan from last March. And when we asked them at committee last week, I specifically said, well, what action did you actually take
to address social care and improve the volume of care packages, but also improve outcomes. And they said, we'll have to get back to you on that. And we do not get detail. I mean, a minister should not be going on to any radio show to talk in sound bites and seek just praise for anecdotal stories that they are aware of. Because whilst we at the Assembly Committee hear that every day, it's not fair on the public. It is not fair that the public don't know that there is a minister who's going to actually take responsibility.
Okay.
And I think it is important to share the stories of what the real life situations are out there, but we also need the action and the detail of what he's going to do.
Well, Nuala McAllister, this isn't fair. I give the minister 30 minutes. I'm going to give you 1 minute to give us your plan, your ideas, your vision, starting now.
Well, for our first idea in the winter pressures would be to ensure that we actually do this shift left and we invest more in that social care. So, yes, I understand that they open up more space for beds, but they don't actually do anything regarding the social care at the top to ensure that those people who are able to get out of hospital, that they can. So I would do that in the first present space. But also I would look at the way in which we invest in the social care where money is wasted, simply throwing down the drain. I've brought to the attention of the minister and the department, both before Mike to Robin, that there is money that is paid to the independent and private sector through social care that is simply not used. It is not actually used for patients. It's there for beds, it's there for staffing, and it's simply not used. What are you going to do about that? We have seen them rectify it in one situation, but there are many more other situations out there. So that's something that we would actually look at too in terms of the value for money. With regards to the immediate
10
pressures,
seconds.
And with regards to the immediate pressures, we would work with the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service and bring in the more volunteers to oversee and assist in our emergency departments, because they have said to the minister that this is something that we can and are willing to do.
You might need more money for some of that.
But you also can stop wasting the money that you currently have. And there is no plan from the minister to actually see what they are going to do about the wastage. They talk about efficiencies, but they do not say, well, this money is being spent, but we're not actually have any outcomes. So how about we change the way in which we spend that money and we plug it into social care instead? That's something that we're not hearing. We all, every party last week, asked them these questions and they weren't able to actually answer in the positive as to what they've done. They talk about efficiencies, but they don't actually say where the efficiencies are and if they're actually tackling the waste in the system.
Straight to the lines, Susan is in Ballyclare and she's now on the Nolan Show. Hi, Susan.
Good morning, Mark.
What's your point?
My question would be, why would he go to the expense of funding another czar? That level of management's going to cost an absolute fortune. How many chief executives of trusts do we have out there? What are they doing? They don't seem to be doing their own job very well. And if that's the case, sack them and get someone else in who can do the job. Why do we need another level of management?
Susan, that's your point. John in Belfast, what's your point?
Oh, hi, Mark. Thanks very much for having me on. Can I just say one thing before I go into my point? It's about those politicians you had on a moment ago. The first thing that I have to say about Mike Nesbitt is this. He's one of the most genuine guys I know and I have met up there in the big house. A very genuine man. What those people need to do is sit down with Mike Nesbitt and simply say, Mike, what do you want us to do? That's the first thing I'm saying. The other thing is this. If I was speaking to Mike Nesbitt, to our minister, I would say this. Has he ever looked outside the box? In other words, to other areas, to other places where they have an amazing health service, like Scandinavia, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and to a certain extent, Paris, France. I remember when I had an earache and I went to an ED department in Paris, I was seen within 10 minutes, and it was cured. What I'd like to say is this. Is there a chance, a possibility, of looking outside the box at other areas, other countries, to see what they are doing and to look at that and look at some of the stuff they are doing and say, I think we should have a go at that because that is working very well there.
Interesting. Thanks, John. Roberts and Bangor.
Morning, Mark. Yeah, I couldn't believe when I heard Mike say that he wouldn't contemplate reducing the 5 trusts down to 1. For a country of this size, this population, why do we need 5 sets of senior management and the whole tier structure that goes along with that? if you had one hospital trust, you'd be reducing four tiers of upper management. That would save an absolute fortune. And also, if they then had the procurement of supplies multiplied by five, as opposed to five independent trusts all buying their own equipment, buying their own supplies, surely when you buy more, you get better discount. You know, if we only need one hospital trust. There's no need for five.
He's on the inside, Robert. He says he has looked at this and feels it might just waste an awful lot of time and effort at the moment. It's more long-term rather than short-term. And because there's a crisis, it's just not the right time.
Well, when will be the right time? That's the problem. Unless you start these initiatives now, they may take a while to bed in, but that you will save in the long run. You know, also the fact that even the different hospital trusts have different computer systems that don't talk to each other. So if you visit the hospital, for example, in Belfast, and then you go to the Ulster Hospital, their computer systems don't know that you've been at the hospital the previous occasion because the systems are different.
I think that's being sorted out on a piecemeal basis, maybe not totally all compliant now, but I think some computers now do talk to other computers. I may be wrong, Robert. You continue.
Yeah. But it's just little things like that. It's
okay.
GP, it all starts with GPs. You can't get to see a doctor. How did we cope before COVID?
Gotcha.
You know, when you had a waiting room full of people, the doctors just they keep coming and saying, we need more money, we can't do enough. You can't get to see a GP.
Gotcha. Well, you can.
You can if you're prepared to be on the phone and get within the first five or six rings. Mm. You know, at 8:30 in the morning, come 8:31, okay. All the appointments are gone.
Robert, hold that thought. John in Newcastle, you hold on as well. I just want to go very quickly to Nuala McAllister and to Colin McGrath to get their party policy on reducing the number of trusts. Nuala.
Yeah, I mean, I think five trusts is too many for one entire region. Not only would we think that there shouldn't be five, that one is the way forward in the long term, but we also believe in transformation and the detail of transformation, which is something that we have not gotten out of Mike Nesbitt, nor Robin Swan, and any other previous minister before them. But that's something that Matt Ryan has said that we're willing to do and needs to be done.
Stop having a go. Let's play the ball, not the man here. In terms of the answer to this particular question.
He asked me in particular what we would support. I've said what we do.
And would you do it now?
Talked about.
And would you do it now? Would you say, right, I'm going to set and train a consultation process about how many trusts that we need with a view to maybe turning it into one?
I probably wouldn't do the trusts now, but I would do the other transformation measures, to be perfectly honest, and that's because we need to get started. There are some issues that you have to do all in its entirety. You need to take a holistic approach, so you need to change services but ensure people have community transport to access those services. That's something that we would actually do in conjunction with other departments as well. You know, if we're going to change a service in one area and ensure people that from Belfast need to travel further, you know, that we expect everyone in the population to do their share, but we need to ensure that those people always have that access, and we would do it through engagement as well with the people that are actually on the ground, both in our hospitals, community hospitals, and in our GP services. We need to ensure that those at the front line are adequately invested in and taking the money into primary care so that it actually changes.
And on the trusts, your policy is reduce the number, but maybe not now.
Well, we are supportive of the fact that it should be a one trust system in Northern Ireland, whether that actually happens right now or in the long term. I do agree with Mike that it wouldn't happen immediately. It would be long term, but there's no reason why, you know, you can't actually assess what it looks like without actually spending the money to do that.
Colin, trusts?
Yes, Mark, I'm still here. In terms of the trusts, if it's going to deliver the savings, if the money can be reinvested back into frontline health services, and if it's not going to be such a distraction to the work that causes more problems, then I don't think anybody, ourselves included, would have an objection to it. But I would be concerned in the short term that transforming five trusts down into one would cause such a major upheaval that it would distract people from dealing with the problems that we clearly face today. Andrea's waiting 300 weeks. If changing the trust around meant that she had to wait 400 or 500 weeks, then I don't think that it's worthwhile. But if we can do it in a way that it can happen and not impact frontline services, I think that it's something we could definitely support.
So you agree with Mike Nesbitt on that one?
I'm not sure if that's his specific line on it, but if it's going to cause problems and it's going to distract people from getting services, then I don't think that it would be something that people would want to see. But if we can do it in a way that it doesn't impact on services, that people can get access to services, then that would be something that could happen. But look, there's been a significant announcement in the last 24 hours that will bring some help to our health service here, and that's the programme for government in Dublin. There is a real interest and willingness in Dublin to try and help and support services. We've got cross-border initiatives that would be facilitated through the government in Dublin if it works in partnership here. If that helps to make waiting lists shorter, that is something that I would like to see. But it just shows that whenever there is an initiative and a government does work together with a programme for government, it can deliver for people, and I want to see more of that here.
Spell that out, because that might be a light at the end of the tunnel. How would that work for us, Colin?
Well, we do have the cross-border initiative, which we need to fund on this side. And also then there needs to be a match of service availability in the south. That has worked quite well for people in the past. It isn't currently operating at the moment. And I do know that there are a number of constituents that come to me to say that they would like to be able to avail of that service. It's not a suitable outcome for everybody, but it is a suitable outcome for some. And I think that if we can encourage that, where people would get their treatment in the south, but it actually would be paid for from the north, it means that then where there is a backlog due to a lack of staffing here, it is a way to try and help people. Yeah. So we need to seize every opportunity, and there's one that the programme for government in Dublin will enable, and we just need our department in the north, our minister here, to work with his new counterpart in the south.
That's interesting. Is that the likes of knee replacements, and you're talking to someone who needs one, that you can sometimes get them in Dublin, or well, at least you used to be, or a hip replacement?
And that's it. And you can, I say the caveat is, I think you have to pay for it first and then claim the money back. But okay, it's all done in such a way that that money is guaranteed back to you. But it means that you're not waiting on a list because there's a lack of personnel to be able to deal with that. And our workforce pressures mean that there is a difficulty in delivering services in a timely manner here. So that's solutions that we should be looking at.
That is interesting. And if anyone has had a knee replacement recently, please talk to me, because mine's coming soon, God willing. Anyway, before we go, we have a minute left. John in Newcastle, the final point on this.
Margaret, I would just like to say that, first of all, Mike Nesbitt had to take a poison chalice. The big powerful parties walked away past it. They didn't want anything to do with it. It was too toxic. And the second one was saying that, well, Mike was saying that there's people maybe about to retire. What does that mean? Does that mean that there's people in the system now who aren't prepared to change, haven't got the big thinking to change, so we'll have to wait till they get their golden egg?
Mm.
How many people's going to die waiting to get their family in order? And the other one I wanted to say was the other day...
10 seconds.
The other day, Colin McGrath stood in Parliament and spoke. And Justin McAnulty was over his right shoulder. And if they bring in changes to Daisy Hill, Justin McAnulty will be one of the ones spearheading protests.
Okay.
That doesn't give me fear.
Well, he can speak for himself, John, but yeah, I take your point generally that sometimes some politicians call for change, but not in their own constituencies. Who knows what will happen in South Down? We'll be talking about the Boyne Bridge after the 10 o'clock news. Thanks for listening to the programme this Thursday morning. Mike Nesbitt, the Health Minister, was talking for the first half hour. For the second half hour, he's clearly been listening to the programme because he's just texted in. As we know, one of our callers was criticising the trusts, saying that their computer systems don't talk to each other. I had in my head that that is changing. According to Mike Nesbitt, it has changed in three of the trusts already. Let me read out to you his text to the programme. Three trusts are on the same computer system already, and all five will be on the same system by May. It's called Encompass. He's listening. I wonder if he was listening yesterday. We talked about the latest twist in the battle over the Boyne Bridge. As we know, the demolition is on hold. We have another twist this morning. As we know, there's this issue over whether planning conditions are being met. Edwin Poots, who's a South Belfast DUP MLA, has been saying to us that this has serious implications, not just for the local area, but for TransLink, and they may need to dip deep into their pocket. I spoke to him just before I spoke to Mike Nesbitt, but we couldn't speak to them both at the same time. It's a wide-ranging issue. We come to that whole issue of what TransLink needs to do next. But I started by trying to get a take on what is going on behind the scenes. I'm told that Edwin Poots met the Infrastructure Minister John O'Dowd at Stormont privately on Tuesday. What's going on? Here's what Edwin Poots has to say.
The planners are still working with TransLink in terms of getting to a position whereby planning permission to remove the bridge could be granted. That's over 2 months after work started on the bridge, and it's after a letter saying that the plan was robust from the planning service, the traffic management plan, and yet today we're still in negotiations and further letters indicating that there's still problems. All of this has turned into a complete and utter mess, and the consequence of it is that business in Sandy Row is being absolutely hammered as a result of TransLink's actions, with most businesses down by 30-40%. And, you know, these businesses won't survive what has happened, and this is purely TransLink's baby as such. And we will be pressing TransLink for compensation for these businesses, because it's purely and solely down to them that these businesses are struggling the way they are.
We'll come back to that. Big picture, to be clear, as a senior member of the DUP, are you in favour of the removal of the Boyne Bridge?
No, I'm not. And the reality is that this proposal came forward many years ago. It was approved many years ago. The minister himself said he was agnostic on whether the bridge should stay or go, but was of the view that it was too late to save it now. I did point out to him that when you take away the drains from underneath the bridge, it is a perfect access for people who are travelling from the city into the station. It's a safe access, they're not having to cross a road, and it's an access where they're actually covered for that point as well. And, you know, the removal of the bridge seems to me to be something which was a flawed proposal. It's an unnecessary proposal. It's £6 million of public money being spent removing something which was in good condition, which would have served its purpose for many years to come.
Edwin, I've known you for a very, very long time. You and I were both there. You're one of the survivors of the class of 1998 when the Assembly started. Be honest with me. If it wasn't called the Boyne Bridge, would you really feel so strongly about it?
Well, actually, we have got the area changed to Boyne Bridge Square, so the name will remain. So that's less of an issue. The William Crossing that area was on a previous bridge, which is still there actually, and we hope to remove cores from it, and to create a whole piece of history around that.
But the point I'm making, this is more about the politics rather than the logistics.
Actually, on the logistics, it doesn't make any sense to remove it.
Okay.
I believe it is purely for aesthetics that it's being removed, and to suit future development in the area. So there's going to be a large development scheme will take place adjacent to the station. And my suspicion is that developers maybe don't like the look of the bridge and think it would look better if it was opened up into a large square.
Okay.
I don't think that there's any logistic reason, and I would challenge anybody to put it out there what it is, but there's any logistic reason for the removal of the bridge. This is purely for aesthetics. It's a very expensive means of doing it.
Back to your point that TransLink should pay Sandy Row traders compensation. Some might say that is totally ridiculous. You can't have any infrastructure project in any big city and close a road for a while without having to pay compensation? Really?
Well, in this circumstance, first of all, TransLink have moved irregularly, if not illegally, to commence work on the bridge. And I think that is a very serious issue.
Did you not just say, though, that they did get the green light? Were you not critical more of the department, saying that they had been told, Translink had been told, that their plan was robust?
No, they haven't got planning permission. And they still haven't got planning permission. They haven't got planning permission today. And they've been told and warned that if they start work on the bridge, again, enforcement action may happen, and they would do so at risk. So they don't have planning permission. They started without it. And the consequence of it is that they closed the bridge for a period of weeks before doing any work. Then they started work, and then they were stopped work because it became clear that they hadn't planning permission. And those months that those businesses are being hurt have all been due to Translink's inept handling of this situation, and that needs to be addressed. This is not the business's fault. This is purely down to Translink and Translink's failures, and they need to address those failures. Why should local businesses go down because Translink haven't followed proper procedure?
What did John O'Dowd say to you about it all?
He's very clear that in terms of compensation, it's Translink's baby. They're responsible, and they would need to address it as opposed to the department. And therefore, we will be pursuing Translink on this issue. I give you an example. The local chip shop, which is down quite close to the Boyne Bridge, is down by 40%. They would have done a lot of deliveries across the bridge to the St. James's area, and it is just impossible for them to do that now because of the traffic congestion that has happened because of the closure of the bridge and everything else. But right up the street, people are saying 30 to 40% trade down. One of the businesses, the dog grooming business, just moved to larger premises because their business was doing well, and now they're looking at potentially closing their business because of the loss of trade. This is grossly unfair on hard-working people,
sure,
who have been doing their honest best to make a living, to pay their taxes, and then a government-owned organisation comes in and causes devastation to their business. It's not on.
You can't make an omelette without breaking an egg, Edwin Putz.
Accept that.
You accept that?
I accept that.
And this new transport hub could be ultimately a game changer for the city. Would you accept that?
It is a fantastic building. It is a tremendous building, and I congratulate Translink on the development of the Boston Transport Centre. However, that doesn't obviate the need for them to ensure that they have a responsibility to other people, not to try their businesses in the process, and to engage properly with them. And Translink haven't done that. I spoke to Chris Conway before Christmas about these things, but I have to say, hugely disappointed at how they have conducted themselves around the Boyne Bridge, and you know, the closure of it, the start-stop process, all of this here has been an unmitigated disaster.
And to be clear, you're calling on Chris Conway and Translink to directly compensate Sandy Row traders?
Absolutely.
Have you a figure in mind?
Well, it's for the businesses and Translink to sort that out, but in most instances they're looking at 30 to 40% trade down, and the problem is the rates are still the same, and the electricity bills are still the same. They're not able to make cost savings here. These are fixed costs, and that all still exist. So whenever you lose 30 to 40% of your trade, that is largely profitability.
This has been flagged for a number of years. Should those businesses not have made contingency plans?
Well, nobody can make a contingency plans for what has happened, because what has happened has been the bridge has been closed for months. A few weeks' work has been carried out on it, and whenever it recommences, it's still going to take close to a year after that to complete.
Two last things. The Boyne Bridge itself, did I hear you say earlier on that the actual 17th century bridge, or at least part of it, is still there and that hasn't been dismantled?
It's, you couldn't touch it. So it was a wooden bridge. It runs over the salt water, and it is still there. So it's in very poor condition, obviously. But that bridge that William crossed still exists.
And just finally, in terms of the big picture, what are you saying to the rest of us who aren't Sandy Road traders about, you know, when is normality going to return? As we know, Plan A, and this could still happen, that the new station redevelopment will be completed by the end of this year. Durham Street will reopen by the end of this year. Is that your understanding, that that is still possible, Edwin Poots?
That's still TransLink's aim, but they would really need to get their act together if that's going to happen. And they could, of course, still decide to retain the bridge. Essentially, what has happened thus far has been the removal of concrete and tarmac, and that's all replaceable. The superstructure of the bridge is still intact. It is a superb superstructure built by Harlan Wolff in 1936. It is a very unusual bridge, and there, from an architectural heritage point of view, it is something of value, and we will be talking further to Minister Lyons on that issue.
Well, the question was about, is the timetable still on track? And I suppose the micro on that is, are you hearing that this planning dispute could be resolved within a matter of days or weeks? We're not talking months here.
They didn't indicate that to me during the meeting, so I think the issues are narrowing, but they didn't indicate whether it would be days, weeks or months.
Interesting. Edwin Poots, thank you. So
thank
the
you.
Obvious question now is, yeah, thanks to Edwin Poots, what do TransLink have to say? Well, we asked the Chief Executive, Chris Conway, to come on. He wasn't available. Maybe tomorrow. It's my last day, Chris. It'd be good to talk to you. Let's move on. Let's talk more about the news that Gerry Adams could be in line for a payout from the taxpayer. This news broke, 24 hours ago. It's because of the repeal that's coming of the Legacy Act, and it could allow dozens, if not hundreds, of those interned without trial in the 1970s, including the former Sinn Féin president, to claim compensation from the UK government for unlawful detention. This is a political story, it's a legal story, it's also a financial story. Just how much money could Gerry Adams get? Alison Morris, the security editor from the Belfast Telegraph, has been trying to work it out. Good morning, Alison.
Good morning.
Give us a number.
Well, I mean, the numbers that were floated at the start, because we're talking probably 400 to 600 internees, both Republican and Loyalist, albeit there's far more Republicans who might have been subject to this. This was to do with the custody orders that were signed at the time of internment. Gerry Adams himself, well, it depends, I suppose, on the length of time that it's adjudicated that people were wrongfully detained during that time, how much they get. But if obviously anyone's looking at the Belfast Telegraph today, that one of the proposals that Keir Starmer's government is putting forward is allowing the legislation to be inserted back, saying the compensation can be claimed, but capping that at £1, which is a way of, I suppose, getting them out of the difficulties that they're currently in. This is a very political story. As you said, Keir Starmer's government has not got off to a great start, I think it would be safe to say, and they're coming under attack from the opposition, from the Tories, in relation to the repealing of this part of the legislation. It does need some context. Patrick Fitzsimons is a test case in this. He was represented in a case in which it was said that to remove the civil cases from in the Legacy Act, which was what happened as part of that Tory legislation, was not lawful. And so the Labour government, rather than appeal that, are then removing sections 46 and 47 from the legislation, and they're going to have to replace that with something else. So you take something out, you have to put something in. The Tories are saying they shouldn't be doing that, because that opens the door for Gerry Adams to get compensation, that they should just appeal that court judgment, because that court judgment isn't right. The Policy Exchange Group have said the same thing, appeal the judgment. What instead Labour are saying is, no, we're not going to appeal it, we're going to replace it with something else, and we're going to do something to try and prevent this compensation. And a lot of this is political because Gerry Adams, what they say is hard cases make bad law. The Gerry Adams case then is going to then dominate what did lead to hundreds of people who were never convicted of anything, some of whom were never involved in any kind of activity whatsoever, being interned during that time wrongfully, are also going to be denied compensation as a result.
And you're hearing it could be possibly only a quid.
So what is unlawful is to say you just can't apply, that we have to remove all civil cases and you just can't apply for civil compensation. And a high court's already said that's not the case. So what Labour are looking at is replacing that legislation with something else, which they say would prevent the compensation. Basically, they're trying to save face in the Commons because they're coming under attack from the Tories. But what do you replace it with? So you replace it with something saying, OK, these civil cases, we can't get rid of them, so they are going to have to go ahead. But what can we do that would be robust to any future legal challenge when we can stop... we can cap the compensation at a pound, and that's one of the things that they're looking at to try and bring this to an end in a way that is obviously politically saving face politically for them. It's been, I think, a lot of this, and what we'll find is that legacy legislation, Labour said in their manifesto they were going to repeal the entire act, that was it, it was gone, and that was quite popular here locally. But what they have found, and I did remember, and other people said it at the time, the Legacy Act is very unpopular here, but very popular in England, where the Daily Telegraph and everything sell it as something completely different to what we know it to be, and Labour are going to then find themselves in trouble, and that's just what's happening now.
Alison, it's interesting you mentioned the Daily Telegraph. I think every broadsheet newspaper in the world this morning led on the ceasefire in Gaza. The Daily Telegraph headline is, "Pressure builds on Starmer in Adams Row."
Yeah, and you can see that they're really pushing that on behalf of the opposition in terms of that is something, I suppose, it's a very emotive case, and they know that if they keep on pushing that's something that they can put pressure on Keir Starmer with. So it is it's a legal story, as you said, but right now it's more of a political story.
Can I ask you a personal question before we go? As a lead-in to our next subject, work-life balance. How good, Alison Morris? You can say no comment. Is your work-life balance?
It's shocking. It's so bad. I mean, I was actually due to be off all over the new year and ended up working for most
You ended up in Spain.
Yes, I did. Yes, and I worked all over
awful
that.
Awful murder then, case.
And then I came back and said, right, I'll take some time off. Now, I ended up still working from that. And then I did take a few days and then ended up having to do things for other people. My phone, if you could see it never stopped. I always say, if there were three of me, all three of them would be busy all day long.
Well, we'll let you go, but keep your radio on, keep BBC Sounds on, because we're going to talk about trying to get a work-life balance. Or do we need one? James Watt, you may know him. He's the multi-millionaire co-founder of the global beer brand BrewDog. He says we don't need a work-life balance. Work should be involved in every aspect of his life. He's able to say that because his fiancée agrees, Georgia Toffolo, and they've been speaking about this. This, believe it or not, is the only social media video that has ever, or one of the few that's ever gone viral, not on TikTok, not on Instagram, not on X or Twitter, but on LinkedIn. Have a listen to what those two had to say.
So I just think the whole concept of work-life balance was invented by people who hate the work that they do. So if you love what you do, you don't need work-life balance, you need work-life integration.
It's so true. And when I met James, I was quite taken aback at how aligned we are on the important stuff. And one of those is lack of work-life balance, but in a really beautiful way. So work knows no bounds. Constantly in our home, we are working. But we do things that we find incredibly fulfilling, and we also have a supportive other half that loves that high-octane obsession with what we do.
Obsession with what we do. Let's speak to two obsessives. Or are they? Patrick Mulholland from the Union NIPSA. Morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Mark.
And Chris Suter, business owner. Patrick, to you first. What do you make of all of this?
Well, I think actually the comments made by James Watt are quite useful because it draws out into the public domain a discussion that needs to be had. So as a socialist, my view is that what work is for is to lift the economic, social and cultural level of everyone in society, the people, the common, ordinary people. Whereas his view would be what work is there for is to lift the social, economic and cultural level of him and his, a very small elite of people. So it's really about the distribution of work. It's really about the distribution of the wealth that arises from work and how that's managed. James Watt gives the impression there that he's all about work. He doesn't really do this work-life balance thing at all. But I could maybe quote James Watt from when he stood down as the CEO of BrewDog, the alcohol company. James Watt stood down for BrewDog, and he said it was to take a bit of time off to travel, to spend more time with his family and friends. I think there is not a worker in this country who would not like to be in the position where their work-life balance allowed them to take off a bit of time to travel and to spend more time with their family and friends. That's exactly what work-life balance is all about, and every single person deserves to have that at their fingertips.
Chris Souter.
Yes, Mark, I think actually, I don't know much about James apart from his business, but I think James just made a sort of a half-decent point, but made it really badly. I flicked through the social channels there, and he's got absolutely vilified. He's got hammered for it. And I can totally understand where the general public, or if you just think of the regular guy, the normal, us, the 5'8", I understand where they're coming from, because he did make it really, really bad, like saying that, you know, the people that want a work-life balance must hate their job. That's wild. But where I started there was, I do think he makes a decent point, Mark, that productivity in the UK is quite low. I think I've been reading through a few things this morning there before coming on, that we rank about 14th in the developed nations on GDP and on productivity. And that, for me, is a problem with our young people, enthused the young people, and just, we just need to enthuse everybody to try and just do as much as they can and work as hard as they can to really get on in life. Like, life's not free, Mark. And, you know, I run numerous businesses, and I work a lot. But to bring this full circle, Mark, I got sick in 2022 from trying to work too hard. You do need a work-life balance. But I think where this point was made really badly is we just need to make sure that we're working hard enough as a country within the right times. And we do take a bit of time off. We do spend it with our family and our friends. And we do disconnect and take away from it, because life can't all be about work. That's not what our humans are built for. But we need to strike a balance. But I just think James made a point really badly.
Patrick?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, just a couple of points that Chris has raised there. I mean, first of all, about productivity. The issue for productivity in this country is we run a low-wage economy that is not based on any investment and any forward thinking. So low-wage economies, by their nature, are unproductive because they are competing with high investment economies who are far more productive. Mm. That's the first. And yeah, we need to move this on from... Okay. Points that don't make any sense. Secondly, the idea that we have a work-life balance in this country at this point in time, that idea needs to be dealt with. Mm. Think about this. In the last 20 to 30 years, we have moved to a position where there's somewhere in the region of 6 million people are now precarious workers, where 4.5 million children are in poverty, where people rely on food banks, and can I say, where people work massive hours outside their contract.
Yes, well, that's what I want to talk about. That's what I want to talk about, Patrick. Maybe we'll talk more about this tomorrow. Sorry, I have to break in there.
No problem, Mark.
Chris, in a sentence, the problem is these smartphones. There is no downtime.
No, that's true. And I think one of the things I'm speaking a lot about, Mark, is telling people, yes, do the work and try really hard when you're in your job and in your work life.
Okay.
But do take time to look after yourself too.
Turn that phone off, but keep your radio on. Connor Phillips is next. We'll see you tomorrow.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there.
I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.